It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios. Welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
It was an exciting election night across the country. Let's start in Kentucky. Officials there not yet calling the governor's race, but Democratic Attorney General Andy Beshear is claiming victory. Republican incumbent Matt Bevin not yet conceding, though. Bevin got a boost from President Trump on Monday when he stumped in the bluegrass state. Overnight, the president tweeting in part, quote, "Won 5 out of 6 elections in Kentucky, including 5 great candidates that I spoke for and introduced last night," meaning Monday. Matt Bevin picked up at least 15 points in last days, but perhaps not enough. In parentheses, fake news will blame Trump. Staying in Kentucky, one candidate there making history. Republican Daniel Cameron becoming the first African-American attorney general in state history. And in Mississippi, Republican Lieutenant Governor Tate Reeves defeating Attorney General Jim Hood. President Trump congratulating Reeves, who he campaigned for at a rally last week. In Virginia, Democrats taking control of the state legislature there for the first time in nearly 25 years. Meantime, President Trump hitting the campaign trail today to stump for Republican gubernatorial candidate Eddie Rasponi. He's looking to unseat Democrat John Bel Edwards in next week's runoff election in Louisiana.
Sandy Rios with you. That is kind of in a nutshell what happened last night and yesterday in the elections around the country. That was Todd Pirro, Fox News. A good day for conservatives in Mississippi, a good day for conservatives for the most part in Kentucky, except for the governor's race, which is still not called, but not a good day for conservatives in the state of Virginia. Let me just say Terry McAuliffe, who is the right-hand man of the Clintons, the money raiser for them, who became governor later, tweeted out, "We did it. We got them both. Hard work pays off. Virginia is all blue." Ralph Northam, the current governor, the one in blackface next to someone in a Ku Klux Klan posing, which we thought would be the end of his governorship. But no, that's okay, I guess. In this age of hyper-racism, it's okay for the governor of Virginia to wear blackface in positioning himself as connected to the Klan. That's okay if he's a Democrat and loves abortion, which he does. And this is what he said. "I'm here to officially declare today, November 5th, 2019, that Virginia is officially blue." So that was a statement from them last night. But as you can imagine, there are a lot of emotions and feelings. On the other side, there was a group of cooperation between many, many conservative groups to try to fight to stop this from happening in Virginia. Victoria Cobb, who's the president of the Virginia Family Foundation, was key to that effort. And I've asked her to join us this morning. Good morning, Victoria.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, not a great night for you guys. Did you know early on that it was trending this way, or what?
We had certainly seen some signs, and yes, it was definitely not the outcome we hoped for. On our Senate, the Democrats took control 21-19, so a narrow margin, but definitely control. And in the House, there's still a House seat that's actually down to 18 votes. So we either know that the Democrats have 54 seats out of 100 or 55 seats out of 100. So for many of us, it's not just the defeat of so many great pro-family candidates, but to your point, it is the fact that this happened when the Democrat leadership right now represented blackface and sex allegations at the LG level and abortion to the point of birth and infanticide. So it's a hard morning for us, but we know our hope is not in politics alone, but it is a hard morning.
No, that's the good part about losing. I have to say, Victoria, in all my years of being connected in races and putting my heart and soul in so many, I've lost a whole lot more than I've ever won. The gut punch is so difficult. And yet I really do think God has taught me in many ways to trust him, which I do anyway. But these are difficult mornings. Let's talk a little bit more in detail. I'm sure now one notable race that I read about, because there were so many to track and you guys were tracking several of them, was that there was a famous picture of a Virginia cyclist who gave the finger to Trump's motorcade. This happened, I'm not sure what, 2017. So it, as it happens, her name is Julie Briskman. She came out and identified herself, and she ran against Susan Volpe, who was a Republican representing Algonquian District in Loudoun County for the Board of Supervisors. And now Julie Briskman, the flip offer of the presidential motorcade, has now taken the seat of the county of Suzanne Volpe in Loudoun County Board of Supervisors. That's an interesting race, an interesting story, and sad. But any other notable races last night that maybe you could bring some insight to us, just personalities and characters that we wouldn't know about?
Well, I think the thing that people need to look at is on the big picture before we get into the details, people need to understand it is challenging when you have $9 million that came in from outside Virginia for the Democrats. That's a 600% increase from 2015. And if in comparison, just to give you a feel, the Republicans have $1.5 million come in for them from the outside, just a 48% increase. So there were factors that were very difficult to come up against. And to your point about the individuals, it did not really seem to matter who these individuals were. If they were wearing a D, the money came in and the left turned out. And it could have been anybody. To your point about we've struggled in Northern Virginia, and this election, unfortunately, showed that it's not just Fairfax County and Alexandria and Arlington, those areas closest into the city of D.C., but in fact, Loudoun and Prince William both went entirely blue, top to bottom. Except for a really rare exception in Loudoun, every single sort of House, Senate option there, and their board of supervisors and school boards flipped. And that was pretty devastating because those are the places that we have those intimate battles in our communities about what are we going to teach in family life education, how are we going to address the issues of bathrooms, locker rooms, shower rooms, field trips with these kids. So it is really disturbing. And there were other individuals, we were hoping that these self-avowed socialists would be taken out of office. And that race had been looking very good up until the very last minute. We had hoped that symbolic seat, if you remember, of Delegate Bob Marshall, who had been kind of a pro-family hero, lost his seat in 2017, if you remember, to Delegate Rome, the first transgendered individual. We had such a great candidate there. And so there were places where the losses were even tougher because of the symbolism. But, I think about it very much like what we saw, in Scripture. It talked about the Israelites wanting a king and wanting a king, and God saying, you understand what a king will do. But God still allowed, turn them over to their own foolishness. And that is, unfortunately, where Virginia finds itself this morning.
I have to observe, Victoria, there's this great article, and I'm sure you're aware of it. I've mentioned it. Actually, this is probably the third or fourth day I've mentioned the article. Fletch Daniels wrote about Fairfax County. It's his home county. And I don't know if you saw it. It was in American Thinker. Great article about how he has seen Fairfax County change. And he reports that by 2015, 30% of Fairfax County was foreign-born. Now, 2015 is a long time ago. And I have to say, I lived in Virginia for many, many years. And one of my first observations when I moved there the last time was that I could hardly find, and now we're talking about all kinds of nationalities. This is not, Northern Virginia is just flooded, and I think Southern Virginia probably is too now. It was almost difficult in the Arlington area to find, it was unusual in restaurants and public places to see native-born Americans. At the DMV, you'd wait in line, you'd see people in all kinds of outfits that were from other countries. You hearing English was the unusual thing, and the people waiting on you at the DMV. There was a Russian concierge. I remember my husband was FBI, and he was trying to renew his license, and she would not accept his FBI ID. She says not good enough, and he had to go home. While dozens of immigrants of some sort were lined up behind him, getting through to the. It was just amazing. So I want to just paint a picture, a vivid picture. I went to a Bank of America and could not hardly find an English speaker. That place was filled with people from all over. So this is what's happened to Virginia. Now, you've been living there consistently for many years. I think that's your home state, right, Victoria?
I've been here for 20. I've now been here longer than anybody anywhere else. So, yeah, I would definitely call it home. And I think, you know, it's interesting. I talked to a naturalized citizen at the polls yesterday, and he was with his wife. His wife had been naturalized enough that she had long enough that she had gotten her registration and was able to vote. His was so close that he actually missed the registration date and wasn't able to vote. But I'll tell you, they understood what America was about. And I think the challenge is we're not teaching our young people, no matter where they come from, when they're in our school system, they're not learning the beauty of the American system and why our founders set it up the way it did and what it believes. And so what happens is we're not helping them, and therefore they're bringing, you know, beliefs that they don't realize that the reason they want to be here is because of the things that have made America great. And it's just disappointing that we can't do a better job of explaining that most of that really is still held in many of the core beliefs of certain candidates, but that the left has really abandoned, and we will see our country look like countries they are leaving very soon if we keep this up.
But I want to ask you, though, you may not be able to answer this. Do you recall when Virginia began to change, when there was so much immigration allowed, in, especially in Northern Virginia? And has it always been that way in your memory, or was there a concerted effort?
I guess there's definitely a recent change, even in Henrico County, where I live, which is right outside the city of Richmond. And you saw Richmond suburbs turn over deeply this election just last night. And so you do see that the voting patterns have shifted, and we have got to connect with folks and handle the immigration problem where there are illegals voting.
Yeah, do you know of any, to your knowledge, well, first of all, I do radio, I should be able to ask questions. Were the races close, or do you have any knowledge of that yet?
Some of them were very close. As I mentioned, you know, out in Virginia Beach, we're still haggling over 18 votes out there. So some of them were very close. Some of them, honestly, we wish were closer. Prince William, we thought the races would get closer than they were. You know, we lost some delegate seats, 52-48 or 53-47. So we were hoping they would actually be a little bit closer. We did hold on to some folks that we were worried about. Speaker Cox, who is no longer speaker but did hold his own seat, you know, they came hard. Part of this is redistricting. Don't forget that Virginians, you know, are suffering the result of the courts stepping in and telling us how the maps have to be in a way that actually was very clearly partisan. They were gunning for our Speaker of the House. They were gunning for Chris Jones, who was sort of number two in leadership in many, many ways, the head of the budget. And they got Chris Jones. I mean, there was just no way for him to win that district because of the way the lines had been drawn. Thankfully, Speaker Cox was able to hold his seat, and he's an amazing pro-life stalwart. And so it would have been truly tragic to lose him. So in some cases, they were close, and we did hold on. In some cases, I really was hoping the races would at least be a little bit closer. It says a lot about how much Hollywood came in and campaigned door-to-door and flooded with the money. And it's hard to get a good message out. But I do think we also need to look deeply at the church. You know, a lot of elections we talk about, you know, where were all the Christians? And, you know, we don't know yet whether they did or didn't show up, because I'll be honest with you, we need to start asking ourselves the question, are churches diving deep enough to really teach folks about why God made male and female, why he put them together in marriage, why he sees human life as so precious. You know, more fundamentally, if we don't teach in the church that we're fallen, broken human beings, and that our government leaders need checks and balances, and that socialism doesn't work when you're fallen, you know, if we don't teach those things, well-intentioned but physically illiterate Christians start hearing about poverty, and they start hearing about injustice, and they start believing that bigger government is the solution.
Yes.
So we have to look deeply, not just at Christians turning out, but also,
totally.
Do Christians know what they believe?
Yeah, Victoria, you're absolutely right. What a great way to put a period on this, and also to challenge people. It's familyfoundation.org, Virginia Family Foundation, familyfoundation.org. Victoria Cobb, thank you for your leadership and fighting on this. Sandy Rios in the morning.
So there's this guy named Jordan, and he's a healthy guy. He's a dad of six, and he works as a guide in Alaska. But then he goes to the doctor, and he's diagnosed with cancer, stage 4. And here's the thing. He had switched from medical insurance to MediShare, which is a Christian healthcare sharing ministry. So the question for Jordan and his wife, Jenny, was, is this really going to work?
Our medical bills exceeded $160,000. MediShare members shared all our bills.
And it was about more than just the money, too. This is a real community.
MediShare is a family, a group of people that stick with you through the hardest times of your life. I just don't know how I could have done it without MediShare.
It's so worth looking into. There's a reason this is growing so fast. If you want to find out more, here's a number for you. 833-44-BIBLE. That's 833-44-BIBLE. 833-44-BIBLE.
Want to hear an amazing story? A jihadist comes to Christ. Hi, it's Michael with Bible League International, engaging the world with the hope of God's Word for more than 80 years. Earlier this year in the Middle East, I met Ahmed, a teenage Syrian refugee primed to be a suicide bomber. He hated his mother and siblings. Why? They came to Christ, and as a radical Islamist, he wanted them dead. But his mother prayed nonstop for his salvation, and when he did come to saving faith in Christ, the extremists he hung around with, they nearly beat him to death and promised to find him and finish the job. This family fled in the middle of the night, but Ahmed has been trained to share Jesus and already has led dozens of young jihadists to Christ. But in Arabic, he cried to me, he said, Michael, we need Bibles. I said, Ahmed, they're coming. Will you join this kingdom work to send God's word to the persecuted church?
Call 800-YES-WORD, 800-YESWORD. That's 800-YES-WORD. Or click sendbiblesnow.com. That's sendbiblesnow.com.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Starnes with news and commentary next.
What do you see for the next generation? Do you see a prospering nation? Do you see hope? The future is ours to create. And Liberty University is driven to train positive influencers for our country and our culture. Our mission is to guide students toward leadership as servants of the people, defenders of freedom, and champions of truth. Discover how you can impact the next generation of champions for Christ by texting GIVE to 839-858.
Well, it turns out the Ukraine whistleblower is a registered Democrat, identified by Real Clear Investigations as Eric Saramella, 33-year-old pajama boy liberal who worked as an analyst for the CIA, a former Obama staffer who worked with former Vice President Joe Biden, and former CIA Director James Brennan. Not so much a whistleblower as he is a deep state swamp-dwelling leaker. Now you understand why Democrats blocked Republicans from asking questions. Now you understand why they tried to redact his name from deposition transcripts. This will not be the last time the Democrats or their cronies in the mainstream media try to float some sort of wacko impeachment scheme. They're determined to take out this president. It's a political death wish. All that to say, don't ever, ever take anything the mainstream media says at face value. Be sure to download my free Toddcast podcast at toddstarnes.com.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the Morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
All right, Sandy Rios back with you. I want to talk about Kentucky for a second. More than a second. I want to kind of unpack this a little bit, as some would say. We know that Matt Bevin, at least at this point, has he is behind by 5,000 points. Andy Beshear, Democratic Attorney General Andy Beshear, has claimed victory, as has the Kentucky Democratic Party. But they're separated by a very small percentage of votes, and so Matt Bevin is not conceding. Now, let me just tell you a few things. Secretary of State Allison Lundgren Grimes is a former beauty queen. She is a very notable partisan, Democratic partisan. Of course she is. She's a Democrat, but she's a vocal partisan. She ran against Mitch McConnell in, I believe, the last cycle. At some point, she's run against him. So she was on with Andrew Cuomo in Cuomo Primetime, declaring victory for Bashir last night. But it's a very interesting exchange, and I wanted you to hear it. This is Andrew Cuomo and Allison Lundgren Grimes. Let's listen.
Despite the president coming here to the Commonwealth of Kentucky to rally for the top of the ticket, we have Attorney General Bashir, Andy Bashir, who will now be Governor-elect Bashir, succeeding tonight in ousting an incumbent in what was and has been a very close and narrow race over the past year.
So, Secretary of State, just to be clear, you are calling the race. You are saying that you are confident that it is over.
At this point, we have, with over 99% of the vote in, the margin is still within about 10,000 votes. And here in the Commonwealth, we have called it for Attorney General Bashir to be the Kentucky governor-elect for the Commonwealth. Obviously, there are still options available for recanvass to be requested should Governor Bevin want to do that. And the State Board of Elections and our county clerks throughout the Commonwealth will heed should that request be made. But at this point, based on the results that we are seeing coming in, the lead is substantial enough that we believe unlikely to be able to be made up by Governor Bevin. The recanvass request, we have official results that are certified to us from our County Board of Elections Friday. A recanvass is requested by next Tuesday and would then be conducted the following Thursday, if that's necessary. In terms of absentee vote totals that could be outstanding, that's obviously something that Governor Bevin could take into account, but not something that we see as a significant indicator here in calling this election. I think this is a return to civility. We have one of the most unpopular governors, if not the most unpopular governor in the nation, who has been unseated by a Democratic attorney general. And despite the efforts of President Trump to come and rally the Commonwealth, it was not enough to help the top of the ticket actually succeed.
All right, that's Kentucky Secretary of State Allison Lundgren Grimes with Andrew Cuomo. Now, I'm not finished with that clip because I just want to insert that she made that statement with him last night. The separation, I believe at the time of that announcement, was 3,658 votes. And that's out of 712,000 votes for Bashir, 707,000 votes for Matt Bevin. So it was like very, very slim margin out of that many votes. So Andrew Cuomo's a little incredulous, and he doesn't back away. You notice she started her statement by saying, despite President Trump coming in to help him. Of course, that's what the narrative is going to be today, and that's what they want it to be. This is a loss for President Trump. See, nobody really likes him, even in Kentucky. That's what the inference is. And so they're going to be making much of this. But again, Andrew Cuomo's not quite convinced, and he continues to press her. Let's listen.
I've had numerous recanvasses in my 8 years as Kentucky Secretary of State, approaching over 20 plus. I think it's worth noting Governor Bevin actually got here by less than 84 votes, winning his primary against then Commissioner Comer, who is now Congressman Comer. He's no stranger to slim elections and slim margins, obviously not the successor in tonight's election. And from our understanding, not just here in the Commonwealth, but the AP as well, has called this election. And we will have our County Board of Elections certify these results to my office this Friday and await any request that might be made by any candidate, including Governor Bevin, by Tuesday, close of business, 4:30.
You sound pretty confident about it. Just for you guys, if you're just tuning in, Secretary of State Grimes from Kentucky says they're calling the race, that they're confident that there are enough votes in right now to say that the sitting attorney general, Andy Bashir, has beaten the incumbent governor, Matt Bevin. We have not called it. I know that will seem unusual that you got the Secretary of State saying it, but not us. But we have our own standards here that we have to follow so that we don't get it wrong. And Secretary of State, I'm saying you sound confident about this in this regard. Have you had a governor's race this close? What gives you the confidence?
Well, in terms of watching the vote totals that have come out, we had a huge lead that came out of Fayette County, indicating a strong straight party ticket voting. But importantly, I think what has propelled Attorney General Bashir to be governor-elect Bashir, that will be sworn in come the end of this year, is what happened in Jefferson County. The lead coming out of Louisville, the most urban area in our state, much too large for Governor Bevin to overcome in the western part of the Commonwealth.
All right, so that's just interesting to me that CNN was not willing to call it, but she was wanting to, and she kept repeating, you know, governor-elect. She's trying to brand that in your minds. Now, Matt Bevin has not conceded this race even now. And she goes into great detail with Andrew about how this might, how he might challenge. There can't be a recount. I don't even want to go into all that, but let's just say that Matt Bevin is issuing a challenge. And now we're hearing that the Kentucky State Legislature might actually make the decision. And they are Republican controlled. So I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen with that. But I was just thinking about this and wondering, you know, why? Because the downstate ballot, the Republicans won handily. And they actually got more votes than Matt Bevin. In fact, the first black attorney general was elected, and that he won by more votes than Matt Bevin got. And there were a couple of other offices, the same thing, where they did a really fine job down ballot, but Matt did not get as many votes as they did. So I was thinking about that, and I've heard people talk about how unpopular he is in Kentucky, and we talked about his relationship with the teachers' unions, and I thought, I want to find out. What is it that Matt Bevin has done that has so alienated people and teachers in Kentucky? And we know it has to do with pensions. We know it has to do with some of the things he said. So what exactly has he said? I want to just give this report from the Louisville Courier Journal that came out in August of 2019. And this is what it says. Governor Matt Bevin suggested in a radio interview Tuesday morning that protesting teachers only caused sick outs while schools were in session because they wanted paid time off work instead of protesting during the summer when it wouldn't affect students. He said the same bill came forward again this summer when nobody was in school and nobody showed up. When it's vacation time, people are a little less worked up, it seems. 10 school districts were shut down for more than one or more days during the 2019 legislative session when large numbers of teachers called in sick and traveled to Frankfurt to protest certain bills related to education and also to pensions. Bevin goes on to say, it's interesting, though, that people seem to most enjoy doing this, stopping work when they get paid anyway. But when they're not getting paid to stop work, it's remarkable. Nobody seems to be that interested. They don't care quite as much. The Kentucky Labor Cabinet was not happy about that. Cabinet Secretary David Dickerson declared that, the Kentucky Labor Cabinet issued sort of an edict, and they said that they wanted to request the names of teachers who called in sick during those strikes when the schools were closed down. Cabinet Secretary David Dickerson declared that 1,074 teachers had broken the law by participating in those sick-out protests. He said they would not be fined. But Matt Bevin said in the interview that while his cabinet could have fined those teachers as much as $1,000 a day, his administration instead will show some grace in this instance, use this as a teachable moment. But he left it open that possibility of firing them in the future if they call in sick to protest. We'll make it clear that this is a violation. If it were to happen again, people could be held to account, and it's not going to be tolerated in the future. And then he goes on to say, educators protest to influence, this is the Kentucky Education Association's comment, their response. Educators protest to influence government action that affects public schools and public school students, not to get out of work that they love and believe in. For the governor to suggest otherwise is unfortunately typical. Nima Brewer, who's the co-founder of Kentucky 120 United, said, told the Courier General that Bevin's comments were another example of a bully who wants attention. Then she goes on to say, Matt Bevin shows up at the Democratic booth in Louisville for the fair and says he wants to be civil, and then the next thing you know, he turns around and pokes us right back in the eyeball. He can't help himself. It's like he has a disease where he constantly has to run his mouth. If he would shut his mouth and open his ears, he might be a better governor. I'm giving you this background because I want you to understand why the teachers are angry with him and what it is he actually said. We have an interaction with him that was a CNN clip that took place, I believe, also in August. And this is Matt Bevin making comments about the teachers in a little different instance. Here it is.
It's crazy to me. You know how many hundreds of thousands of children today were left home alone? I guarantee you somewhere in Kentucky today, a child was sexually assaulted that was left at home because there was nobody there to watch them. I guarantee you somewhere today, a child was physically harmed or ingested poison because they were home alone, because a single parent didn't have any money to take care of them. I'm offended by the idea that people so cavalierly and so flippantly disregarded what's truly best for children? You know how many children live in urban communities and rural communities where there's a single parent who literally, if they could afford to skip work and not lose their job, they couldn't afford to because they need the money. They don't have a backup for them. They don't get paid whether they go to work or not. They don't have an option. And some of them were given literally a matter of hours. So you know for a fact that there were hundreds of thousands of children who were left unattended, and some of them in communities where people knew that for a fact and took advantage of it. And as surely as we're having this conversation, children were harmed, some physically, some sexually. Some were introduced to drugs for the first time because they were vulnerable and left alone. It's offensive, frankly. It really is.
All right. You can imagine how the teachers union and the teachers, those are the harsh remarks that Matt Bevin has made that they were so angry about. Plus, as I understand it, he's been trying to find a way to preserve their pensions. It's the striking and taking off and calling in sick that he has a big problem with. And you notice he made a shot on them again. He said these single moms can't stay home from work and still get paid. In other words, like you teachers can. You can go off and do these brave acts, but you're still getting paid. And so that's hard talk. That's harsh talk, but I guess I probably agree with him. And I know that I am not happy with the way schools have gone. It's long before they went off the cliff on social issues. They became a very hostile, self-serving group. I'm talking about the teachers' unions, not individual teachers. Some can be wonderful. Of course they can. But they are swallowed up with the culture of the unions, and I'm not a fan. So that's what his crime has been, and that's why he is so unpopular. So he's not conceding the race, and we'll find out what happens. Now, there's also another election coming up on it's Louisiana. It's coming up in a few days. The president is going to be rallying in Louisiana to support Republican candidate Eddie Rispon against Democratic incumbent Governor John Bel Edwards, and that will be another, I wish I could see where that, I know it's this month, it's in like a week or so, but I'm sorry, I don't have the date in front of me, but that's coming up in Louisiana, and you know we'll cover that too. So that's kind of the story coming out of Kentucky, the story coming out of Virginia. Mississippi had, they'd had a Republican sweep, and so the conservatives of Mississippi are probably pretty happy tonight. I want to change to transfer a little bit. This has to do with elections, but national now. CNN, interestingly, has been doing man-on-the-street interviews and not getting the results that they want. They were in Michigan interviewing a voter on the economy, and this is how it went down.
UPS worker Stephen Place says it's the Democrats who deserve to have what's coming to them. He says for undermining a president who has done so well on the economy.
Look at the real estate. I mean, house goes on a market, it's gone in a week. I mean, the economy's just booming.
Since Trump's election, the state's unemployment rate has dropped nearly 1 point.
All right, so that's CNN. And, there's a whole string of those, and that's just one of them. I think that's amazing that they even aired that, but they did. And they've been airing other interviews like that. Meanwhile, back over on Telemundo, I think it's Telemundo, it's the Hispanic channel. One of their anchors, whose name is Janiot, I'm sorry, I sound like a Frenchman. I don't know how to pronounce it. Janiot, J-A-N-I-O-T, said this, interviewing Democratic National Chairman Perez. Mr. Perez, President Trump has achieved something important, especially for Latinos, which is to reduce the unemployment rate to historic lows. How then can the Democrats compete with a president that has been beneficial to Latinos on economic matters? And Perez stumbles and stumbles. He said, the economic situation in the U.S. is excellent for the wealthy like Trump, but the economic situation is still bad for our community. But that's the point is, they're notoriously to the left, and even they are calling out the Democrats on the good economic numbers for Hispanic Americans. And a poll has just come out that shows only 33% of Americans believe partisan impeachment probes should be Congress's top priority. It's an APNORC survey, shows that the majority, 53% of adults, believe the House Democrats' impeachment inquiry is politically motivated. Those polls are not going well for Democrats, and I just wanted to encourage you with that information. Stay tuned. So much more to tell you. There always is. I'll be right back. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Do not participate in the fruitless works of darkness, but instead expose them. My name is Abraham Hamilton III, and this is the Hamilton Minute. Following the implementation of the Trump administration's new rule that prohibits funding for family planning clinics that perform, promote, or refer for abortion under Title X, 876 baby murder proponent clinics across the country have lost federal funding. With the new rule, the clinics had to choose between serving women and supporting baby murder. Those who chose to support baby murder no longer receive Title X money. This frees up that money to go to community health centers that do not perform, promote, or support killing children. This is great news for our nation. We must protect the innocent and most vulnerable among us.
Listen each weekday from 5 to 6 p.m. Central for the Hamilton Corner with Abraham Hamilton III, public policy analyst for the American Family Association.
We're pilgrims and strangers in a foreign land where we're not recognized, where often we're criticized, and the journey through the mountainous terrain to the place to which God has called us can often be difficult. There's truth in these Psalms to help us as we make our way.
Join Dr. David Jeremiah for his series, When Your World Falls Apart, next time on Turning Point.
5:30 a.m. and 7 p.m. Central on American Family Radio.
AFR's own J.J. Jasper is a morning on-air personality, author, comedian, Christian, and family man. J.J.'s also a keynote speaker at banquets, men's ministry events, pregnancy center fundraisers, and more. Here's what others are saying.
This is Amy Richmond at Life Choice Ministries in Manhattan, Kansas. Several board members and donors told me that this banquet was our best banquet ever. Thanks to J.J. Jasper.
Information on J.J.'s availability to speak at your event is at jjjasper.com.
Brian Fisher here with today's Life and Liberty Minute. While we tend to think of millennials as people who think of themselves as hot rocks, a new survey of millennials reveals that 8 out of 10 believe they are not good enough, that's a quote, in virtually all areas of their lives, including work, romance, and meeting expectations. But it turns out that's the good news. The Bible tells us that none of us is good enough. That's why we need a Savior to redeem us from our failures and a Savior to help us meet the demands of life. Paul said, not that we are adequate in ourselves to consider anything as coming from ourselves, but our adequacy is from God, who has made us adequate to be ministers of a new covenant. If a millennial is looking for a source of adequacy and sufficiency, they can find it in the indwelling life of Jesus Christ, and that's very good news.
Catch Brian Fisher on Focal Point, weekday afternoons at 105 Central on American Family Radio.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The national security crisis at our southern border may just have been transformed from something that was dismissed, derided, and ignored by congressional Democrats to a reality that demands action. That could be the effect of the ambush and massacre of at least 9 American citizens by drug cartels yesterday in an area of northern Mexico just south of Arizona. If so, the question is what, if anything, will now be done? Will we finally finish building the wall? Will we put troops along the border to help secure it? Or will we, as President Trump just proposed to his Mexican counterpart, dispatch U.S. troops into Mexico to root out and destroy the gangs that killed Americans there and that are killing untold numbers of us with their drugs and violence here? The question should be all of the above and more, including interior enforcement. This is Frank Gaffney.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
You have to see who the whistleblower is.
A direct call from the President of the United States for the public outing of the whistleblower's identity.
You know who it is. You just don't want to report it.
A sentiment echoed by Kentucky Senator Rand Paul just last night at a Trump rally in Kentucky.
I say tonight to the media, do your job and print his name.
But in an age of text messages, Twitter, and 24-hour communication, news outlets have yet to publish the name.
The whistleblower statute was never meant to give you anonymity.
It was meant to allow you to come forward without being fired.
Not entirely true, according to Stephen Cohn, an attorney representing whistleblowers for 35 years. He wrote a book called The Whistleblower's Handbook and represented Linda Tripp when her name was outed during the Clinton Lewinsky scandal.
For any politician, elected official to urge publicly that the law be violated, it's most troubling and irresponsible.
A law passed in 2014 offers multiple protections for whistleblowers, including anonymity and no retaliation. One person who must follow that law, the President of the United States.
The law, it couldn't be clearer. Quote, the President shall provide for the enforcement of this section. Period. The President. The President must protect this whistleblower. The President must tell Rand Paul to stand down.
If a member of Congress leaks the name, the member could be censured or forced to give up committee assignments. Members of Congress receive dozens of complaints each year, but the sensitive nature of the complaints stops them from becoming public. This case is different. Cohn tells Fox News a small group of people are supposed to know the whistleblower's identity. Top brass at the Intelligence Community Inspector General's office know the name, and the chair and ranking members of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees likely do as well. Officials here at the Department of Justice tell Fox News no one inside this building behind me, including the attorney general, know the identity of the whistleblower. Brett.
Yeah. Well, David Spunt on Fox last night and much ado about something here. I've told you I kind of find it hard to believe that no one inside the Justice Department knows the name that I know, which is Eric Chiaramella. You heard Todd Starnes announce it a few minutes ago. Also, I've been telling you this probably, I don't know, maybe 2 weeks. Eric Chiaramella, I've known about his name. I've told you about Real Clear Investigations, Paul Sperry outing him and describing what he's done, who he's connected with. He was working with CIA Director John Brennan. He worked with Joe Biden on the Ukraine issue. Joe Biden was the vice president. President Obama charged Joe Biden to be in charge of Ukrainian policy. Now, we know that Hunter, the son, ended up on the board of this Burisma energy company, making money hand over fist. We know that Joe Biden ordered the then president of Ukraine to stop an investigation into that company. He bragged about it publicly. That, by the way, was quid pro quo. And so now they're accusing the president of what Joe Biden actually did. That's true. They are. And so Eric Chiaramella had a front row seat to all of that. Many people are saying, well, he should be called as a witness. He has also been in the White House on the National Security Council under President Trump, one of those people that should never have been present in that room, serving under General McMaster, who I told you was a deep stater, finally was let go by President Trump. But meanwhile, Eric Chiaramella did a lot of damage. He leaked a lot of things. He was finally he brought into the White House during President Trump's tenure, someone who was a Ukrainian-American who supported Mrs. Clinton and led that effort to link the Republican campaign to the Russian government. I could go on and give you his contacts, but maybe that's enough for now. We'll repost Real Clear Investigations article on our Facebook page, and that is Eric Chiaramella. It tells you all about him, at least partly. One of the reasons why I am not the whistleblower statute was sort of one of the people that was very involved in that was Senator Grassley. And so he's all alarmed that Rand Paul should be calling for the name to be published of this whistleblower. You can understand now why the senators, based on David Spunt's reporting, and members of the House are hesitant to say anything because the statute would punish them if they published that name. And so Rand Paul was on with Brett Hume last night. Brett Baer. And I wanted you to hear a little bit of how Senator Paul feels about the whistleblower statute and this particular whistleblower. Let's listen.
I don't wish harm on anyone. I've been the victim of political violence not once but twice. I was there at the ball field when Steve Scalise was almost killed. A staff member was 10 feet from me who was shot. I had six of my ribs broken by a hater of President Trump, so I know what political violence is all about. I don't want that at all. But the report was not correct in the sense that the statute says the inspector general can't reveal the name. It says the president should enforce the law, but the person you quoted was disingenuous in what they were saying. The statute says the inspector general can't reveal the name. There's nothing that prevents me from saying it now other than that I want it to be more about the process and less about the person. But there's no law that prevents me from mentioning the name of who's been said to be the whistleblower.
But
there's
also...
Yeah. And there's something important also. It's called the Constitution. The Sixth Amendment to the Constitution says, if you are going to accuse me of a crime, I get to stare you down in court. That is absolutely part of the Constitution. The statute might say one thing, but I promise you, if there is a trial, you always get to confront your accuser. It's in the Sixth Amendment. It's in the Bill of Rights. There's no way they can stop the defense from asking.
Well, I don't understand what prevents you from getting on the Senate floor where you're protected on all kinds of things and just giving a speech and saying what the guy's name is, if you're convinced you know who it is.
No, I can, and I may, but I can do it right now if I want. Nothing stops me. There's no law that stops me from doing it. Other than that, I don't want to make it about the one individual. But I would say this. I do think that this individual is a material witness to the potential Biden corruption. He was there under Joe Biden. He was there when Joe Biden was trying to fire the prosecutor that was investigating Hunter Biden. So this person was a Ukrainian expert on the desk at that time. I think he should be interviewed not as the whistleblower, but as a material witness to the Biden corruption in Ukraine.
Yeah, so that's part of what Rand had to say. You know, we should listen to the rest of it. Let's just go ahead. Next clip.
I think the whistleblower is a material witness to the Biden corruption because he was there when the Biden corruption scandal was going on. There are reports that there are aides to Joe Biden who counseled that it was a conflict of interest for his son to be making so much money. That should be investigated, and the whistleblower was there at the time. If the whistleblower is now talking about President Trump, what did the whistleblower think at the time, and what did he write and say to Joe Biden about the conflict of interest with Hunter Biden? He needs to be interviewed for that purpose alone, but also the president's defense, because of the Sixth Amendment to the Constitution, will get to confront him. No judge will turn that down. He will, if he wants to, get to confront his accuser.
Understand. But to my question, what about the substance of where we are now? Do you have any problem with what you've read, heard about the phone call, the fallout to it, and the surrounding?
I guess the only thing that I've discovered after looking at both sides on this is that everybody seems to want to influence the aid to Ukraine. Biden said, we'll cut it off if you don't fire this prosecutor. Menendez said, if you don't keep investigating Trump, we'll cut your aid. Murphy was there a month ago, and he says, if you investigate Hunter Biden, we'll get rid of your aid. It seems like everybody on both sides of the aisle has been threatening Ukrainian aid. And if I'd have been on the phone, I'd said you don't get any because we don't have any money. We got to borrow it from China to send it to Ukraine.
All right. So that's part of the exchange. It was lengthy last night. Now, here's the thing. This whistleblower, many people say leaker. What is the difference? I ask you. I'm not asking you. I'm not asking you to call. I'm just asking you to think about it. This guy says he heard about this. He didn't hear the call. And now we know his connections. Do his connections as the accuser and his link to John Brennan, his link to Joe Biden, which is how this has been spun, that the president was asking for the Ukraine to investigate his political rival or he would withhold aid. That's not what the president said at all, but that's what they say he said. Is it not suspicious? And do we not need to know kind of who he is, where he's coming from? And is he a whistleblower or is he a leaker? And is there a distinction? I mean, I'm sure the statute surely must make some distinction, but that's the confusion. But I'll tell you why I am not bound by any sense of honor in releasing Eric Chiaramella's name. And I'll tell you one of the reasons the Democrats are going after two of the staffers for our friend from California, the congressman who's so good on this, he has two staffers who are all over this. And now the Democrats are going after them with a vengeance. In fact, they are starting an investigation, and they want to accuse him of leaking the name of the leaker. But from my understanding, Derek Harvey, who's one of the two assistants, why am I blanking out, you guys? Devin Nunes. They work for Devin Nunes. One of the two is Derek Harvey. And that name is public, too. Derek had nothing to do with this Real Clear investigation article. And so, but they're going after him. They want to ruin their lives, and that's okay. They're going to talk about their names, go after them. You know, they're it's a free-for-all. But we can't know who Eric Chiaramella, with the background that he has and the accusations that he has made, we are not to know, because that, ladies and gentlemen, might be a bad thing for Eric. It doesn't matter about the others, but it matters about Eric. Now, here's another story that's pretty much a blockbuster. This is from Larry Johnson. Now, I think Larry is a former, let's just say, intelligence agent, somewhere connected in his life, and I wish I could tell you, because I don't know. He is connected to the intelligence community. And this is the title of his article, Growing Indicators of Brennan's CIA Trump Task Force. The average American has no idea how alarming is the news that former CIA Director John Brennan reportedly created and staffed a CIA task force in early 2016 that was named Trump Task Force, and given the mission of spying on and carrying out covert actions against the campaign of candidate Donald Trump. It was a specially designed covert action to try to destroy Donald Trump. A task force is a special bureaucratic creation that provides a vehicle for bring case officers and analysts together, along with administration support for a limited-term project. But it can also be expanded to include personnel from other agencies like the FBI, DIA, NSA. Task forces have been used since the inception of the CIA in 1947. A task force operates independent of the CIA. So what did John Brennan do? I'm told by a knowledgeable source that Brennan created a Trump task force in early 2016. It was an invitation-only task force. Specific case officers, men and women who recruit and handle spies overseas, analysts, and administrative personnel were recruited. Not everyone was invited, accepted the offer, but many did. This was not a CIA-only operation. Personnel from the FBI were also assigned to the task force. We have some clues that Christopher Steele's FBI handler, Michael Guetta, may have been detailed to the Trump task force. So what kinds of things would this task force do? The case officers would work with foreign intelligence services such as MI6, the Italians, the Ukrainians, and the Australians on identifying intelligence collection priorities. Task force members could ask NSA to do targeted collection. They also would help have the ability to engage in covert actions such as targeting George Papadopoulos. Joseph Mifsud may be able to shed light on the CIA officers who met with him, briefed on operational objectives regarding Papadopoulos, and helped arrange monitored meetings. I think it is highly likely that the honeypot that met with George Papadopoulos, a woman named Azra Turk, was part of the CIA Trump task force. There has been some informed speculation that Guccifer 2.0 was a creation of this task force. In light of what we have learned about the alleged CIA whistleblower Eric Chiaramella, there should be a serious investigation to determine if he was a part of this task force or, at minimum, reporting to them. There's more to that article, but that is a blockbuster. That John Brennan actually formed a CIA task force to destroy Donald Trump. I mean, we've been speculating about it, but now it is being written about and talked about openly by people who have inside information on the agency. I want to give you one last, I know there are other pieces of news, but this stuff maybe you'll only get from me, so I'm going to move ahead here. I want you to know that in the Lieutenant General Flynn trial, I read yesterday to you this astounding filing that Sidney, his attorney, on behalf of General Powell. It's Sidney Powell, and she made the filing on behalf of Lieutenant General Flynn. So now the people that are prosecuting Flynn have made a jaw-dropping counter. They say, we just realized we got the notes mixed up. The notes we've been talking about really weren't written by Peter Strzok. They were written by the guy with him. So they're claiming that the whole thing is reversed. It's much more complicated than I can describe to you in the 30 seconds I have left here. But this is nothing short of stunning, and Sidney Powell's not going to take this one. She talks about somebody is lying, maybe, probably, more than just one person. Okay, so stay tuned on that story, too. And for the rest of the news, you'll have to turn on television because I didn't get to all of it. All right, Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.